Good afternoon, honorable members, support staff of the committee, members of the media, South Africans, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the meeting of the Standing Committee on Appropriations. We are having an engagement with the Department of Higher Education and Training. Welcome to the department. Let me check who's leading the delegation of the department. Darren?
Chairperson, the Director General is on the platform.
He's on the platform. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That's fine. DG, Mr. Konde. Welcome with your team. I'm told it's only you on the platform.
Thank you, Chair.
Oh, welcome. Good, thank you. Let's go through the agenda. Are there any apologies?
Yes, Chairperson, we received apologies from Mr. Mlenzana, Ms. Ndlangwini, and Mr. Sheikh Imam.
Those apologies will be noted. DG, Mr. Konde, you are welcome with your mission. How much time do you need from us? And introduce your team, please. DG?
Or to introduce the team of the department. No, thank you very much, Chair. Let me take this opportunity to greet you, Chair, and the honorable members that are accompanying you. In the meeting, I've got the officials from the department. It's Mr. Faisal Tofi, who is in my office, Chief Director. It's Ms. Lula Mambopo Vava, who's the DDG Corporate Services. It's the CFO, Chief Financial Officer, Ms. Priti Makukule. We've got Mr. Sam Zungu, DDG TVET Colleges, Dr. Tandi Lewin, Acting DDG University Education Branch. I think those are the officials that are here from the Department of Higher Education and the Training. There's also Ms. Gasa. Ms. Gasa is the DDG Planning Branch here in the department. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, DG. You are welcome with your full bench. if I may check, I just said, how much time do you think you need for your presentation?
I think it will be done in 30 minutes.
Perfect. 30 minutes. If you need to stretch it to 45 minutes, not beyond 45 minutes. But from now onwards, I go back to you. You'll direct us to how you want your team to come in and so on. You'll only speak once you say you are finished with your presentation with the department. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Chair, for this opportunity to invite us as a department to make a presentation. We have invited the Chair, people who are in a very sad state of affairs, very poor, and we really welcome any opportunity to present ourselves with a view that would actually be getting some support to overcome the challenges. In the main, Chair, the structure of our budget, the bigger chunk, if I may just demonstrate a classical example. In the budget from the voted funds, we have got around 94 billion. Out of that amount, 78 billion goes to the university sector, 12 billion goes to TVET sector, 2 billion it goes to community education and training colleges. It may appear that universities are having a lot. Yes, they get a better share, but out of what is insufficient itself. And one of the challenges that sector is confronted with as a result of the revamp and increase in NSFAS funding, which in the main is around 41 billion. Then the transfers to institutions, to universities, is around 43 billion, which is putting a very dire situation in respect to the sustainability of the system for it to be able to afford adequate infrastructure, physical as well as IT related, and also be able to acquire facilities that would enable it to teach and afford learning by students quite very well, and conducting research amongst other things. And coupled with that, we're struck by budget cuts, which is a very painful situation we've ever been confronted with, the extent to which the cuts have happened. We'll come in and present it, Chair, with a view of trying to demonstrate the impact of these cuts and the threat it poses to the system as a whole, that is the post-school education and training system, and how it would impact also in relation to the achievement of some of the targets, especially those that are enshrined in the National Development Plan. I will ask Dr. Thandi Lewin to quickly come in, just run through the presentation and we entertain questions. We brought here a full complement of the management, and if there are any questions and engagements, then we'll entertain them thereafter, Chair. Thandi, quickly, you heard the Chair in respect to time constraints. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chairperson, Honourable Members, and thanks to the DG and my colleagues, and I also greet colleagues from Treasury that I see are here. Thank you very much for this opportunity. DG, I should go through the whole presentation or bring in TVET?
Which one will minimize time? Yeah, if TVET comes, they should also run quite quickly. You share the time that has been allocated.
Okay, no, that's great. I think I'll do that, because otherwise it will appear that, as usual, the universities are dominating the discussion, because, of course, we dominate the the budget of the Department of Higher Education and Training. But thanks very much, DG. I think I should share the presentation, Chair, if that's okay with the honourable members. Share the screen. Oh, I'm not enabled to share. I don't know if perhaps the committee secretary would be able to share the presentation for us.
Karen, can you share the presentation? Karen?
Let me start so long, and then
just a second, and just
okay. There we go.
Good. Yeah. Thank you. Go on. Let's go on.
Thank you so much.
Sure. Darren, go on Good. Yes, there you are.
Thank you very much. So just in terms of the outline, we have done a overall service delivery implications just as an overview, and then we will talk specifically about TVET. I'll ask my colleague in the TVET branch to come in there and then talk specifically about universities. Also a section on the long-term sustainability of NISFAS and possible future financial implications of the university infrastructure damage. Those last two in specific response to questions that we had received from the committee. Thanks very much. So as the DG has already indicated, the overall service delivery implications are quite severe for us, bearing in mind, of course, that there have been reductions across government. The department's budget is, in fact, dominated by transfer payments, as well as the cost of the compensation of employees. And this includes the remuneration of examiners and moderators in the TVET and CET sectors. And certainly the decrease in baseline funding is impacting negatively on our operations. Definitely you will be aware of the effects of the reductions in funding on the poor students that are being funded through NISFAS. The budget cuts there have had quite a severe impact, which I will talk to a little bit later in the presentation. If we do take this into account, though, with the earmarked allocations and such as those for the rental of accommodation, the actual administration costs of the department are relatively low at only about 0.5% of this budget. But critically for us, because so much of the department's funding is in the form of subsidies, a very big responsibility of the department itself is for the monitoring and evaluation of the system. We've just had a meeting with the portfolio and select committees this morning where we were reporting on the department's role in trying to understand the lessons learned in terms of the impact of COVID on the post-school education and training system, particularly the impact on teaching and learning. And a lot of the work that we do there is reliant on our ability to properly evaluate the system and monitor it on an ongoing basis. There's also a danger that the non-filling of vacant positions will impact on the achievement of key delivery targets for the sector. So that's a key issue for us. Next slide, please. In view of the deteriorating macro fiscal outlook caused by the COVID-19 pandemic, the budget vote has been cut by 20.8 billion. That's over the medium term expenditure framework period. It's a very significant cut for the department. And just to give you a sense of the largest budget reductions, the NISFAS, the National Student Financial Aid Scheme, is a key one. Obviously, significant funding flows from the department to NISFAS on an annual basis. And over the medium term, the current medium term framework, the cuts are just below 7 billion rand. Unfortunately, this is not sustainable in the current environment where, in fact, the demand for funding has increased substantially. And you will know, honorable members, that the department has had to reprioritize funds towards NISFAS in this financial year, the 21-22 financial year, in order to cover this reduction budget because of the increased demand for NISFAS and the shortfalls at NISFAS. And because of the deteriorating economic challenges, of course, we're finding that more and more students are qualifying in terms of the government policy for supporting poor and working class students. The cut to the university budget over the medium term is 7.7 billion. And of this, 5 billion is on the subsidies, the university subsidies in general. Which in the bulk of which goes to support the core operations of universities. And 2.4 billion is in university infrastructure, which is earmarked funding that is provided specifically to the sector to address infrastructure challenges, the development and the growth of the system, to support key projects such as student housing development and many other areas. So we'll talk a little bit about that. The TVET cuts to the colleges, it's 1.426 billion. Obviously, Chair, these reductions will appear largest in the university because the university subsidy budget is the largest allocation in the department. And of that, 947 million over the medium term cut is on TVET infrastructure cuts, and also 400 million on the college subsidies, which my colleague will talk about are already under quite a lot of severe strain. Compensation of employee budget cuts, as across government, these cuts over the medium term are 4.634 billion. Thank you. Next slide. In terms of compensation of employees, our concern is, of course, that we've got a number of advertised critical vacant positions where attrition has taken place. And those are critical for eliminating capacity constraints, may then compromise us and may there's always the possibility of leading to retrenchments. There is a very strong view that currently our available staff in the departments are already carrying above normal workloads. We are experiencing quite a high level of staff burnout, stress levels, and quite low staff morale as a result. Also, the downward adjustments in the state-funded enrollment in TVET and the possible reduction in staff there. There's been a significant impact, Chair and members, on the CET sector, as the budget cuts really do affect the standardization work that is going on in terms of the CET college structures, as well as implementing the post-provisioning norms for CET colleges. And of course, this does raise the potential for labor unrest due to a lack of adequate funding to fully implement the standardization. Regional offices are also playing a very key role in evaluating both the TVET and CET sector. And we're concerned that the budget cuts will directly impact on the delivery of these services. Next slide, please. So I'm going to hand over to my colleague on the TVET side for the next 1, 2, 3, 4 slides. Mr. Zungu, are you okay to come in and just talk more to the TVET side? And then I'll come back in on the university's chair, if that's okay.
Thanks, Dr. Lewin. Thanks, DG, and greetings to the Honorable Chair and the members. I will also be very brief. But just to highlight the most important points, Chairperson, I know Dr. Lewin has already highlighted the issues that talks to budget cuts around the infrastructure backlogs that colleges have been faced with over the few years. And I think budget cuts will have a serious impact on that. Also around the issue of the cost of employment, as she has already alluded to, this, of course, as colleges are busy introducing what we call the post-provisioning norms, which has been long outstanding from the college's side, and as we are about to implement and then we are facing budget cuts, it will have serious impact as well in terms of the delivery of the curriculum by the TVET colleges if the budgets are not increased. The other issue, Chair, that I wanted to raise, that the targets that have been set, as the DG was highlighting in terms of the NDP, in addressing what we call the inverted pyramid, where we see a number of young people going to universities as opposed to TVET colleges, cannot be addressed if we are faced with these budget cuts. And it is one thing that we probably as a country need to look at, because there's also issues around what we call the needs, those that are not in employment or education or in training, which is growing in numbers. You will see that in terms of this service delivery protest, that the majority of the participants in those service delivery protests happen to be young people, which are not in employment or in education. And if we have to, as a country, have to make priority, it will be also to look at how can we prioritize TVET education, because it does create opportunities for employment, opportunities for young people to start their own businesses. And I think if we decide not to invest in that, it will be the biggest mistake. Next slide, please. Well, this is just the table that illustrates what my colleague has already highlighted. I'll just go straight, because in terms of time, I'll just go straight to the total TVET budget cut from the original indicative estimates of national expenditure to final.
that over the next MTF, we are looking at a total budget cut of about 4.3 billion, as well as the impact on the student enrollment TVET, COE or cost of employment and subsidies, at a total of about 9.17% over the MTF budget allocation. The 2021 APP targets, headcount enrollments in TVET colleges and state funded, looking at about 505 million. And then the TVET enrollment reductions, a total over MTF budget allocation of 138 million. Next slide. This is just to illustrate the budget reductions relating to TVET compensation, as well as TVET direct transfers will relate to the following headcount reductions over the MTF budget. In over the 3 years, you're looking at 838,899, as I've already alluded. The budget reduction of 3.3 billion relating to TVET compensation, as well as TVET direct transfer subsidies over the MTF will collate into TVET headcount reduction of approximately 139,000 enrollments over the MTF. Next slide. Budget reductions of 70 million relating to operationalization of new TVET campuses. As you know, that the department was busy rolling out a project that was pronounced some few years ago in terms of trying to increase access by building more campuses. It will equate to new TVET campuses that will not receive additional funding for enrollment and maintenance requirements. And the existing intake at current campuses will have to be reduced to cross-subsidize the new campuses from existing baseline. Furthermore, the budget reduction of 928 million relating to TVET capital infrastructure and efficiency grant over the MTF budget will have a negative impact on infrastructure maintenance at TVET colleges. As you know, Chair, that the neglect that has been in the TVET sector is actually more than what one would probably take at the moment. So if that cut will actually result into us having to regress from the progress that have been made over the past year, where we have seen some improvement in terms of the infrastructure maintenance and development within the TVET sector. The next slide. I think I'll just hand over to my colleague, Dr. Lui. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. So this slide then shows the reductions to the university education budget. Starting with last year, the baseline allocation is shown at the top, and then the baseline cuts. And we did have once-off reductions during the financial year last year in order to address the COVID-19 pandemic. And those cuts in 2020, last year's budget, amounted to 2.6 billion, quite severely affecting in particular the infrastructure grant. The same is true for over the medium term. This shows the effect. You can see that the substantial cut of 9.37% in 2021-22 is partially due to the baseline cuts, but also it also shows there we have put in the reprioritization for NISFAS, which will be processed in the medium term process. But of course, we've had to reprioritize from within the department to support the NISFAS shortfall. Later in the presentation, there's a bit more detail on this. And then you can see that the reductions grow to 5.9% in 22-23 and then to 7.52% in 23-24. You will understand the block grant is, of course, the bulk of the funding subsidy that goes to institutions, and it's the predominantly a discretionary fund that goes to supports the core operations of universities. The earmark grants are in a range of areas, but the biggest allocation there is in the infrastructure and efficiency grants. You can go to the next slide, please. What I wanted to just talk about a little bit more generally is the impact on the universities, and just to reflect a little bit on the impact of the cuts. I've already indicated the funding support goes to, but certainly to indicate that the COVID-19 pandemic has had quite a significant effect on the university sector. It really does. It has highlighted for us some of the deep inequalities that exist both in our society and that impact on access to and success in higher education, but also it shows sometimes the inequalities that we have in our institutions. And many of those we are trying to address with the funding that is provided through particularly in the AMR grants and the infrastructure funding. So we do still have, of course, a number of inequities from the past as well, as students, particularly because of COVID, universities have had to grapple with some of the challenges of immediately making multimodal forms of learning available to students. And institutions have had to grapple particularly with the need for infrastructure support. And although the common view, the sort of common sense view is that in the longer term, if you move towards more online and blended and distance forms of learning, that costs reduce in the longer term. Unfortunately, that's not true for the short term, because one needs to ensure that the adequate ICT infrastructure is in place, that there's adequate training. And it also is our view that in the contact institutions, that although universities will develop towards more and more forms of blended learning, utilizing much more technology to support teaching and learning, that this will not in any way replace the need for face-to-face and contact learning in our university system. Unfortunately, time won't allow me to go into that discussion in more depth. But also to say that in our university system, we have had the COVID-19 pandemic comes on top of very many years of fiscal challenges in the system and disruption that has taken place because of student funding issues in particular, and the difficulties around weak economic growth and have really affected that as well. And the ministers, the increase in the funding in 2018 and 2019 to universities, which came about as a result of the significant inputs from the fiscus into the university sector, unfortunately, are starting to be eroded. And of course, they came on top of quite a number of years of the university budget being unable to keep up with the growth in the system. So what we've also seen is that even though we've been investing significantly more funds, we haven't necessarily been able to catch up with that kind of growth. And we're also seeing, unfortunately, honorable members, we're seeing a significant growth in student debt in the system. And of course, this is student debt predominantly of students who are not NSFAS funded. And in 2019, the student debt in our university system is sitting at approximately 14 billion rand. So in a sense, as much as we are trying to address the funding challenges in the system, unfortunately, the COVID pandemic is really, and the reductions that we're now experiencing are in fact reversing some of the gains that we were beginning to make. What this means is that we will need slower enrollment growth in the system. We are in the middle of an enrollment planning cycle. We have a multi-year planning cycle where we work with the universities. The enrollment plans determine the amount of funding that is provided in the system. They are critical for guiding the affordability of the universities, meeting the enrollments, but also in terms of assessing the infrastructure and human capacity needs of the system. So in 2022, we will be doing a midterm review of those enrollment plans. And it is highly likely that we will need to reflect on the level of growth, which unfortunately has already reduced quite significantly. And we may have to look at the possibility of enrollment reduction. The challenge with this, of course, is that the demand for university education, as well as the success levels and the access of students coming from the schooling system, is growing. So the number of students qualifying for higher education has grown significantly, and we're not able to meet that demand because we're not able to grow the enrollments at the rate at which we could provide quality higher education and training to students. One of the biggest effects you will see from the slide that I showed you, and again from this year's reprioritization, is infrastructure growth is going to be severely constrained. This includes addressing backlogs in the maintenance of our infrastructure in our public institutions, as well as further restricting growth in student housing and other important areas. On the other side of things, however, we do want to say that we are giving quite strong signals to institutions that they do need to manage their finances and funding very cautiously. And I think this is an area that, you know, we're going to have to report on much more, that universities are aware of the fiscal situation and the need to be very, very cautious and careful about how much funding, about how their budgets are operating. And of course, those signals are unfortunately starting to be felt. But of course, it does mean that we need to focus on ways of finding efficiencies in the system and working out ways in which we can operate more effectively. But overall, they are very serious constraints to our goals in terms of the National Development Plan, as the DG had indicated. Next slide, please. This is just to show you that we've had to reprioritize funding from within the 21-22 budget, and this just shows a breakdown of where we have taken that funding from. And this is hopefully a once-off reduction to the budget only for this year. And of course, you will know that we are engaged in a process to look at the student funding issues in the medium term. But of course, the biggest effect, as you can see, the 56% reduction is in the infrastructure and output grant. And unfortunately, what this means for this year is that the first phase of our sixth IEG cycle, which was intended to focus on building on supporting institutions and improving their ICT infrastructure, unfortunately, that entire phase is having to be postponed. So also there's a reduction in capital funds to the new universities, which is going to slow down growth in those two universities. And then the bulk of the other cuts are in the earmark grants. The reason why we've done that is to really try and protect the core operational funding of universities so that we're able to keep the universities functioning effectively, which is critical for all the students in the system. And the other grants are relatively, the other cuts to the grants are relatively small, although you will notice that essentially we're postponing work on the, what is the HDI development grant, the now called the Sibusiso Bengu development grant, which is supporting our HDI universities and is critical to trying to address the inequalities in the system. And then of course you can see that the NSFAS grant was reduced, but again, we'd be reprioritizing this particular funding is being reprioritized from the university budget at 2.4 billion, but also funds are going to be flowing from the National Skills Fund and also from TVET infrastructure cuts. Next slide, please. I think I will go really quickly through this because this is more about the immediate budget reduction, and I don't want to, I've already given an overview of the general effect on universities, but essentially there is some, maybe just to on this slide to show that there is some cut to the research output budget in the block grant, and this actually affects all universities. As much as it affects research-intensive universities quite seriously, it affects all universities which are doing research, and it affects particularly universities that are trying to grow their research. And in the context of reductions that have also taken place to the DSI budget and the NRF budget and to other research entities, this is quite serious for us. If you could go to the next slide, please. The clinical training grant and the veterinary sciences grant and the foundation training grant are earmark grants that provide particular support to key areas where we have scarce skills requirements. And those reductions, however, have been kept to a minimum. We should be able to address those immediate shortfalls within the with the universities over this year, and hopefully in the longer term we'll be able to make those up, because this is a once-off reduction. But I've already spoken to the infrastructure cuts. Essentially, we've had to basically postpone an entire program around ICT infrastructure because of this reprioritization. And it's going to have a very severe effect and delay on infrastructure development in the sector. Essentially, in this 21-22 financial year, we do not have any new infrastructure funding. We are only addressing projects that were already requiring support in terms of the previous cycle and where cuts had been made last year. Next slide, please. I've already talked about the effect on the new universities and the new developments here. Of course, you will know that we're also doing feasibility studies on two new universities that were announced in the SONA, but obviously the development of new campuses and new universities will be heavily dependent on the fiscal availability of fiscal funding going forward. Next slide, please. The University Capacity Development Grant is a critical grant that is used to support teaching and learning development, supporting projects that are focused on student success, also the staffing of universities, and the key to the transformation and development of staffing in our, particularly in the academic staffing area, and also in the curriculum development area. However, the cuts, there will be some cuts, but it will just mean that some projects will get delayed. Next slide, please. I think the next slide should be on the NSFAS plan. And I'm aware that my time is coming to an end, but this is a really critical discussion, Chair and members, around the long-term sustainability of the National Student Financial Aid Scheme. And you will most certainly know that in Cabinet, we addressed Cabinet in March 2021 as a department. And Cabinet instructed that the Department of Higher Education and Training, working with National Treasury, had until the end of June, which is now a month away, to address key issues in relation to the challenges that are faced by the sector, in particular to look at how we can address the student funding policy, address a more comprehensive student financial aid model, and look at the long-term sustainability of student financial aid. And this is critical work that we are engaged with at the moment, working very closely with NSFAS and National Treasury. It's quite a lot of technical work, but the Minister has also appointed a task team, which is going to be working with experts from the sector, which should shortly get underway. And that work will look at the assumptions that we need to make in terms of the modelling work that needs to be done, and also look at what policy changes might be possible, given the current funding constraints and the need to ensure a long-term sustainable financial aid system, both for TVET colleges and universities, for the PSET system as a whole. And the different scenarios then will be dependent on that outcome between ourselves, National Treasury, and Cabinet. And of course, it's likely that we will have to take a slightly longer time to do some of the policy work. And it's likely, of course, that changes will have to be phased in over time. Next slide, please. Given the fact that the work is currently underway, we're not able to necessarily present those proposals at this point, but we will be in a position to revert to the committee once the exercise that we currently engage with is completed, and also once we've received feedback from the technical process from Cabinet, hopefully at the end of June in a month's time. And I've talked to the task team. If you could go to the next slide, please. Thank you so much. This set of slides talks about a specific question that we were asked to address by the Standing Committee, which is a very serious concern that is out there about the damage that happens to our university property when there are student protests. And of course, in the past, we've seen that there's been significant damage. This year, we did have some unrest at the beginning of the year linked to student debt issues and the delays in confirmation of funding for first-time NSFAS-funded students. However, much of that didn't result in significant damage because many students were not back on campus and assessments were still going on in some universities. And in fact, quite a lot of that protest happened outside, unfortunately having a significant effect on the public. And you will know also in one case resulting in a tragic death in Bromfontein. But the responsibility really does lie with universities in terms of managing property and ensuring that they have adequate mechanisms in place to limit protests when it does happen and to protect people and property where necessary. In this regard, most universities are in fact enrolled in the Tertiary Education Risk Insurance of Southern Africa, and protest damages are covered as part of this of the risk that universities are paying under their insurance policies. And so some universities are able to claim from their insurance, or they sometimes do have to dip into their own funds to cover the cost of damages. Next slide, please. There are some figures that we'll give on past support that we've given. So in terms of the quite exceptional experience that we had during the fees must fall process in 2015 and 2016. In that year, the department actually allocated significant amounts towards damages at 5 historically disadvantaged universities, and those figures are provided there. Those universities were Fort Hare, Zululand, Western Cape, Walter Sisulu, and Limpopo. That amount was allocated from the department to assist those universities towards damages. However, the damages were significant at other institutions too. Given the funding challenges, of course, the department is actively engaging with other key stakeholders, particularly with University of South Africa, in addressing the issues around damage to property during protests, but also to find more innovative ways of preventing protests from taking place and to managing protests more effectively so that to limit harm both to individuals and to property. And there have been a number of engagements over the past few years with in terms of the training of private security, for example, and also quite key engagements between University of South Africa and the Minister of Police and between the two ministers as well to try and look at and other key stakeholders to try and look at more long-term sustainable plans and risk mitigating strategies around this matter. The next slide, please. I'm not sure if my colleague is here, but let me just talk to this as well, because I think that we must not forget that the impact of COVID on our skills development sector, and in particular, the skills levy that collections that fund significant parts of our post-school system and our skills development systems has been reduced significantly. So the skills levy collections reduced from 19.4 billion to 12.4 billion because of the 4-month skills development holiday, which was introduced as part of the COVID-19 tax relief measures. And these were announced by the president in April 2020. And this led to us having to revise targets downwards in the department and also in the CETAs, in the APPs, the annual performance plans of the CETAs for the financial year ending the 31st of March 2021. And these figures have been presented to the portfolio committee. So the COVID pandemic also and the reductions as a result of that have had significant implications for the CETAs in the delivery of workplace-based learning programs such as learnerships, work-integrated learning apprenticeships and internships. And the majority of CETAs had to apply to exceed their administration budget, which is done in terms of Section 14.3B of the Skills Development Act, the Act of 1998. And of course, the QCTO, the Quality Council for Trades and Occupations budget, also decreases from 122 million to 95 million. And that is because of the contribution of the skills development levy towards the costs of the QCTO. And maybe, Chairperson, just a last comment from me on this. You will also know that in terms of this year's in-year reprioritization of funding to support the NSFAS shortfall, the 6.4 billion that was required to do that, that we've also had to request support from the National Skills Fund in order to contribute to that shortfall. And what that does is also reduce funding available for skills development in the broader post-school sector, not just in the universities, but in the TVET colleges and particularly in the CET sector, and of course, support for unemployed people as well. So it really does affect in the long term, the role of the NSF to support skills development more broadly in government. And I think, Chairperson, that is the last slide from the department, and I'll go back to the DG in case, or the CFO in case I've left out anything critical. Thank you so much, Chairperson.
Okay, DG, CFO.
No, thank you very much, Chair. That is the crux of what we wanted to share with the committee today in respect to the strains financially and also in terms of resources in the system. We are working on quite a number of other considerations in the form of leveraging partnerships, getting donations, you know, other kind of support, you know, every opportunity that is available. We are looking at it. For instance, on infrastructure, as we are experiencing constraints financially, we are also applying to the budget facility for infrastructure in the National Treasury, which is a fund they keep from other sources other than voted funds to assist where it is appropriate in the rollout of infrastructure. We are utilizing every opportunity that is available at our disposal to actually mitigate the impact of these cuts and shortfalls in the system. But in the overall, this is the situation which is actually confronting us at the moment. Maybe the CFO may want to share with us. I don't know whether she has got a secret, you know, in her coffers, you know, of anything perhaps we may not be aware of, but that is the situation that we find ourselves in. CFO, through the permission of the chair, if you want to say anything.
Please proceed, teaching the CFO.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair and Honourable Members. DG, I think all the critical points are well covered. And just to answer your question, unfortunately, at this point, we don't have any secret pockets as yet. So we, as DG has covered it very well, we're leveraging on other available funding sources, be it in the public sector through the bidding processes, or through a partnership with other organs of state. Thank you very much, Chair.
Back to you, Chair. Thank you very much for affording us this opportunity.
Thank you so much, DG, and your team for the presentation. I think it's the first time we interact with the Department of Higher Education and Training. Just to close the loop, the Standing Committee on Appropriations as to how we work. We are a product of the Money Bills Act, as the Standing Committee on Appropriations is even for the benefit of the people who may be on the platform. For the first time, we have got an interest in what is happening at the Department of Higher Education and Training. As the Standing Committee on Appropriations, we are a committee of National Assembly. What happens is that when the Minister of Finance presents the budget to the House in February, that we always say that that budget is a proposal to Parliament, and then gets sent to Standing Committee on Finance and the Standing Committee on Appropriations. Standing Committee on Finance deals with the fiscal framework and the taxes, by and large, that the minister is introducing, and we deal with the Division of Revenue Bill and the Appropriations Bill. So you are coming here today is the process of the dealing with the Appropriation Bill as it was presented by the Minister of Finance in Feb. Then we decided to invite you because we saw that they, well, let me say, as you know, all departments have had budget cuts. So so wanted to hear from you what's happening from the horse itself. But again, what is important, I'm not going to take you back to the genesis of the situation that we're in as far as the economy of the country and the fiscal is concerned, which was exacerbated by a COVID-19 pandemic. But that's the reality that we're in now. One of the things that we really want to hear from the departments is to how the departments deal with the reality of these budget cuts. And we would like to believe that these budget cuts should be transitory. They shouldn't be permanent. And the only way we can come out of this is that the economy grows so that SARS can be in a position to get more money, so that SARS can then finance us, and then we deal with other fiscal challenges like the debt, which is ballooning. So I just thought let me give you that. Then once we've listened to the departments, we don't meet all the departments at stroke SOEs. We choose, and then we do make a report, make some recommendations to the National Assembly. We debate the appropriations bill there before it goes to the National Council of Provinces, where it also goes through the same process, depending on what happens, and then goes to the president. I just thought that I should close that loop, since the first time we are interacting with your good selves, and there may be some members of the public who follow what is happening in your department, DG. So it's also very important for the benefit of the public to know what we do here. Having said that, honorable members, it's your chance to interact with the presentation. Can I have indications of the honorable members who would like to have a say on the presentation by the department? Honorable Shonyana. Thank you.
Peters.
Honorable Peters. Yes, honorable members. Well, while other, yes, honorable members. Who that? I'm listening, honorable member. I can see somebody is trying to come in. Who's that? Okay, I'll go back to him or her. Let me start with Honorable Shonyana in the meantime. Honorable Shonyana, please break the ice for the committee.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Well, we welcome the presentation. I don't have anything really much to say about this presentation. The only thing that I wanted to raise, Chairperson, was that we are not happy about the minister, Blake Nzimande, not being here today, nor the deputy minister, and nor them giving apologies of not being with us today. That's all.
Noted, Honorable Shonyana. Honorable Peters.
Chairperson, thank you very much for this opportunity, and I think you are correct by indicating that it is the first time that we are meeting as this committee was the Department of Higher Education. And I want to take this opportunity to thank the DG and his team for the presentation, but also to upfront apologize for the inconsistency of my connectivity because of network challenges. Chairperson, I want the DG to, because the minister is not in attendance, to give us his impression and his indications on the feasibility and possibility of a whole-scale free education for, in particular, the missing middle and the poorest of the poor in South Africa, taking into consideration the challenges that we have of the high rate of inequality, as well as unemployment and poverty. And I, quoting from, not necessarily verbatim, from our late former president, President Mandela, first president of the Republic of South Africa under a democratic state, who indicated that it's only through education that the son of a farm worker can become a president or even the principal of a school. So I think it is important that we realize that education, in particular, access to tertiary education is a catalyst for breaking the back of poverty and intergenerational poverty. So I would want to hear from the DG on that particular possibility, and also on as a present, how far have we moved as a country in terms of making it possible that those who qualify to be covered for intervention through the grants of government for access to education have been able to benefit from it. But also how the department is able to minimize the wastage that we see every time NSFAS monies are paid out to students. Because for some reason, the day the NSFAS monies are paid to students, it's the day that the liquor outlets and other festivities are happening. And living in an area where there is the new university on my doorstep, and thanks to the ministry and the department, we are happy as the Northern Cape that we have the University of Salt Lake here. But what happens, and I know it is by nature the type that students can behave that way, but not necessarily just every day, but in particular when the day they have received the money starts at NSFAS. But I also want to know whether there has been any savings from universities for the 2020-21 financial year due to the impact of COVID, especially on the restrictions to physical class attendance, plus the issues of student accommodation and catering. And I'm asking this, Chairperson, because quite a number of universities were closed throughout most of last year, and the students had to rely mostly on online learning. So has there been any savings, in particular where there would be students living probably at the, what is it called when you they don't live in the university residences, but the residence that is procured from outside? So I think it is important that we know if there's any this thing. But also, I didn't hear much, maybe it's because of the inconsistency of my connectivity, about the long-term plan of the department. I know that budget cuts would have a bearing on that. I've seen the indications that infrastructure for the new two new universities is affected by the reductions and the budget cuts. But I would want to know, what is the long-term plan of the Department of Higher Education for student accommodation? Because the number of students are going to increase, and we are very excited and happy as a country that the number of young people who enter tertiary education is increasing, and in particular the young women. But it is important to know that there is also projections and planning for student accommodation. I know that during the time of the PICC, there was discussions about alternative building materials for student accommodation, so as to be able to make sure that universities can actually, within the radius of the university, be able to accommodate the students. But also, student accommodation is not a luxury. It affords those students with security, because they would be living within secure environment provided by the university. Because this outside accommodation and all over the city's accommodation is also risky, especially for the women, because I would believe that quite a number of the students are also victims to GBV in the campuses, also during study times, because you'd find that the university library is on the premises, but the accommodation is elsewhere. So it's important that we get to know what is the projections. But also, DG, it is painful that we have our young people who qualify from your TVET and your technical colleges, who needs to personally look for on-the-job training so that they can qualify to graduate. Many of them don't have access. We've got people who come to our constituency offices who say, I've been 5 years or 4 years or 3 years out of the university, but I can't graduate because I still don't have the graduating training opportunity. And I think it is important that you realize that it is difficult, especially for young people who come from other centers, other than the major centers, to literally go door to door looking for this job placement. Why is the university and the colleges not ensuring that they provide through the engagements with companies? I know that the Minister of Higher Education used to say every workplace is a training ground. And if every workplace is a training ground, then it is important that the universities themselves or the Department of Education, through the Department of Labor and Employment, or the Department of Trade and Industry and others, be it even the Department of Minerals and Resources and Energy and the DPE itself, emphasizes as part of the requirement for CSI and other MOIs for the training of these learners, because it is painful, truly speaking. I know of many young people who I literally have to shrug my shoulders to say, I don't know how I can help you. And it is painful because they have gone to tertiary education, they have studied engineering, but they cannot qualify because they don't have an opportunity for on-the-job training so that they can graduate. So I want to hear from the department what is it that they're doing to enable these students to get that opportunity. But also, Chairperson, how much is the Department of Higher Education working together with their component in the science through their component, the science and technology area? And researching should be the ideal funding for research and development in South Africa. I'm raising this because countries like Singapore, countries like Korea and Russia, they invest a lot in research and development. And that's why their manufacturing ability in the economy is growing. And at most times, even as a country, we know that most of the time our technical or our technology gadgets, we compete about which one we have from which particular country. It is about time that we compete about which one we have from our own country. So I think it is important that as this committee, we hear from the Department of Higher Education and Training, what is it that they believe should be the quantum of funding for research and development? What is the budget of CSIR? Is it, according to the DG, adequate for us to be able to intervene in the economic recovery space? But also, you know, it is painful that we are lining up for vaccination, for vaccines that comes from even our own partners. Russia has got Sputnik, India has got AstraZeneca. What do we have as South Africa? Is there any partnership that we have as South Africa with any of these vaccine developers to be able to say this vaccine would be something that we can also be proud of as South Africa that we have contributed? And I think South Africa for many years, even during the discussions about HIV and AIDS and others, have been talking about the South African Vaccine Initiative. How are we faring with regards to this South African Vaccine Initiative? Are we doing well, or is it something that we can just close our eyes and ears and say we are not succeeding? Because as this committee, we should be able to know how much of the budget of the department or of the entire budget of the country should we be spending on research and development. Chairperson, I would for now say thank you, and if given another opportunity, I will come back. But for now, I'm fine. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Peters. And let me again thank the DG and the team for the presentation. I think at the heart of our questions, DG, is the impact of the education output, the impact of the investment that the country is making on higher education, and the point that is being raised by Honorable Peters, it depends. Higher education may say the impact is seeing the number of graduates that come out. But somebody who's sitting in our committee would say, no, ultimately would like to see that impact in the economy and the betterment of the lives of our people. So if somebody, for instance, gets a degree or a diploma, but can't find a job or can't find in-service training, then we'll say the impact is it's minimal. So that's basically where we are coming from. Perhaps let me start there. That ladies and gentlemen, you'll remember that in the old days, there was so much in-service training happening in the state-owned companies. For instance, if you talk about in-service training, if you look at Transnet, you look at PRASA, you look at AXA, you find all types of engineers there. So we should be saying, why is it not possible to place our students in the companies that we own? And I know the first thing which is going to come up is the question of budget from those companies. What I also want to throw back to you is the training money from the seekers. How would it be, for instance, if a student comes out with an engineering thing, or he needs in-service training, we place him at Transnet and say, can you take this student for 2 years? And we are going to pay him a stipend for those 2 years. And the only thing that Transnet or PRASA or AXA do is just to make sure that it gives an opportunity to that young person to have a on-job training. In fact, as Honorable Peters was talking in one of our chat group where I'm with Honorable Peters, an honorable member spoke about some students who have just qualified on a number of things, but I remember it's what aeronautics graduates, and the place where these students can, in fact, they were trained outside the country, so they need a placements. So working with our SOEs, I think one of the things that we have been grappling with in our committee is our departments and entities and companies working in silos, not being able to get the synergies that we have ourselves before we even go to the private sector. So the question there, is it something that we may consider that we talk with these entities and we pay for them from these skills levy that we're having, especially coming from the CTAS? I'll tell you, sometimes you find people who say that we have been trained on these, and that these companies will go around and train, but to find that at the end of the day, nobody takes those people who have been trained by certain companies. I'm saying companies who just go to CTAS and get money and train in whatever they feel like training. So a specific training with our SOEs, I think, would be more relevant than the general training. Then my other question, I just want to check again with the department, how efficient are we as government in terms of supporting, for instance, our students? I know there's NSFAS. I'll tell you where my question comes from. If you go to all these departments that we are having, you'll find that there's one form of a bursary, one form or another of a bursary, which is being given by the department. Do you think that's efficient as far as we as government are concerned? Is there no possibility of double dipping? You know that students sometimes can be very creative, but if you have got many government departments, provinces, national government departments, NSFAS, do you think that we are efficient? Is there no possibility of double dipping there? And what can we do to ensure that we get maximum output from the support that the government is giving to its young people? Another question would be, they say one stitch on time saves nine stitches. One stitch on time saves nine stitches, which is a problem that we as government generally were having, the question of maintenance. But I would refer to the universities, especially those the historically disadvantaged universities. I've seen some of the universities and say they are not even painted, simple paint, and that these budgets that we do give out, these subsidies that we give out, what type of oversight we give, because I think it's the easiest thing to get a paint and paint university. I think many of the people are on this platform know what I'm talking about, and these are the universities who produced a lot of people who are on this platform today. But when you look at the state of maintenance, windows not being replaced, and so on and so forth, and the question is, what type of oversight do we give? Then there's this question which usually troubles me, what I'll call the marginalization or the discrimination of students who come from these historically disadvantaged universities. The job market is not absorbing them, at least that's my observation. But what is even more troubling, that even government discriminate when it comes to employment opportunities for young people who come from these universities. One, I would like to hear from yourselves, do you agree with that statement? And if you do, what can be done? Especially Charity Begins at Home, we as government and as state-owned entities, and obviously going to the private sector, we can't perpetuate these types of discrimination in the present South Africa. I think I just wanted to check the rate of uptake by the market of the output or the students who have graduated from the TVET colleges. From the TVET colleges. That talks to the relevance of what we give in our TVET colleges. In your presentation, you spoke about the bias towards, and I think generally, but you spoke about the bias towards universities as compared to going to TVET colleges. Don't you think that it may have, obviously there are many explanatory variables to that, but I'm just thinking that if somebody gets a good pass, it's called the bachelor's pass. So by implication, once you pass there, you want to have a bachelor of something which you'll get from university. Don't you think that has got an impact on the careers that the students end up choosing, or perhaps the institutions they end up going to, TVETs compared to the universities. Well, we'll request that you said that you were tasked by the cabinet to look at to come up with some solution which will address immediate funding challenges. Please, DG would also like to have sight of that once cabinet have seen it and approved it. CTAS, again, it has something to do with the type of training. Is there any correlation between the training that is funded by CTAS and employment creation? Yeah, I think for now I'm fine. I'm sure you were picking up my points on as I was putting them to you and the honourable members. Honourable members, let me just check that is there something that you would like to add before DG and his team come in? Honourable Shanyana? Honourable Peters? Okay.
I'm still fine.
Okay, thank you. DG?
All right, thank you. Thank you very much, Chair. Thank you for these quite intense questions, Chair. I came here with the impression that the SCOA is going to assist us to get the money that we don't have.
In fact, this is just before you cut in, but you are reminding me, right? We are dealing with the Department of Higher Education. So these are the people who come up with ideas. Hence my question was, please also tell us how we're going to deal with this budget cut now and going forward. And I've tried to help you that going forward, I think the answer is in the economy, which is growing. There are no two ways about it. So that's why what you do must end up impacting on economic growth at the end of the day. Back to you, DG.
Yeah, no, thank you very much. Thank you very much, Chair. Let me ask DDG Sam Zungu and the Dr. Thandi Lewin to come in first, then I'll come thereafter with some of the directed questions and what may have not perhaps explained quite sufficiently. If the chair allows. Mr. Zungu, can you come in? I think there is a question in respect to a placement, web placement of students from TVET colleges.
Thanks, CDG, and thanks, Honorable Chair and members. I think Honorable Peters is asking a very important question, which also came from Honorable Chair, in relation to the work placement of TVET graduates. Just a bit of background that ordinarily, when TVET or technical colleges were designed back then, they were designed for people who were already employed, and they would have gone and attended the technical education on block releases from their companies. But then with the growing demand of the country having to skill a number of young people, the gates were then open to a number of young people for them to come and get the skills. And at some point, Honorable Chair, TVET colleges or then technical colleges were referred to as sausage machines. And that was as a result of them having to produce a huge number that could not be placed or absorbed by companies. So there has been ongoing discussions between industry through the skills branch with CETAS to assist in engaging with the employers to open up gates for young people to be placed. But as you know, with the issues of our economy shrinking, those workplaces continue to shrink as well. But what we've been discussing, Honourable Chair and members, is that we should not just be focusing on big corporates for work placements. Honourable Peters referred to the slogan by our Honourable Minister that turning every working place into a training space. Now, one of the biggest challenges has been the fact that the CETAS will have the funds for paying stipends, as Honourable Chair was saying, could go to ESCOM or all the state-owned enterprises. But the biggest challenge is that those big corporates will only have limited spaces to accommodate all our learners that we produce in the system. So the growing number and the demand of training the number is growing, but in terms of the workplaces, those are shrinking. So the discussion that we are having now with the skills branch, our sister branch, is that can't we have the Skills Levy Act, you know, somehow to try and accommodate even the non-skills levy paying companies to accommodate young people for work placement? Because you might find that there's a small company which can assist in training maybe an electrician or a plumber, but it's small. It does not have the money to pay, or it's not registered as a skills levy payer because of its size. I've made in other presentation example of Germany, for instance, where the majority of training of apprentices does not happen in big corporates, but happen in small businesses. And I think it's one of the routes that we can take as a country as well to say how do we extend the scope of the skills levy paying companies to also accommodate those that are not skills levy payer. But also the fact that the skills that are acquired through TVET colleges should not just be focusing on students that will come out with CVs, but it's also focusing on students that will probably be directed towards entrepreneurial activities where they can be able to start their own businesses instead of seeking employment. Let me make an example, Honorable Chair. I know the time is limiting. If you train, for instance, students in hairdressing, and we look and we drive around all the major cities, you'll see the hive of activities in hairdressing. But the majority of those people who are doing the hairdressing is not our local people. It's mainly sometimes it's people that come from outside and they've invaded that space. But if we train our young people, assist them in establishing those small businesses of hairdressers, I think that could also assist in creating employment, not just for them, but also for others. I can go on with a number of examples. For instance, in hospitality industry, you go to taxi ranks, you go to all over, people are selling food, but it's not people that are trained to do and provide healthy food. It's people that just do it because they just need money. So I think there are areas where after the students in TVET colleges have acquired certain skills, they can immediately walk into entrepreneurial activities, but they need guidance and support from the funding entities and also some of the government departments that can also assist, like the economic development, and see how can we put together fundable business plans as young people, because we have now acquired the skills. Mechanical guys, welding, boiler making, all of those people, plumbing, all of those people can easily walk out and start their own businesses. I think, Chair, in terms of that, I think we are working in trying to improve in terms of work placement. It's not easy, but it's something that we are working on. Thank you, DG. I hope I've answered the question, and thanks, Honorable Chair.
Thank you. Tandis, please. crisp to the point.
Sure, DG, thank you very much. And thank you, honorable members, for the questions and the comments. I think it's there's a lot of food for thought there. And the question that the chair is asking about how we deal with the cuts, I think, is an important one. The reductions, of course, over time do have a significant effect. And we often, in a balancing act to try and ensure the sustainability of our institutions over the long term, and particularly to ensure that the subsidy levels are adequate to support quality teaching and learning, to support also the growth of the system that is expected, that is required in order to provide the high-level skills that we need for our society and economy, and to ensure the sustainability of our universities, but also to build capacity and also to transform our system, which is a complex issue. It involves addressing staffing, infrastructure needs, of course, as well as improving teaching and learning. So I think that certainly this year has been quite a shock in terms of the need to reprioritize within our budget, and what we can do, while trying to maintain the sustainability of the system, is to ensure that we limit the cuts to the core operations of institutions, and in some stages what it does mean is that we have to postpone delivery of certain projects, particularly the developmental infrastructure projects, and we just have to also work with universities to assist them to become more efficient in the way they manage their funds, and we do engage regularly with universities in several fora on these matters so that we can keep them informed about what's happening at the department level through the budget processes, but also in terms of our own expectations of universities maintaining their own financial health and sustainability. So we do quite a lot of monitoring and engagement on that. But just to say, Chair, that in the long term, of course, if we do see a continued erosion of the subsidy levels and growth in enrollment numbers, and what we find that we have to manage enrollment growth in line with the fiscal constraints. In the long term, we will erode the capacity of our institutions to improve quality and to grow. And so that's really a key issue, and maybe to indicate also that in this policy review process that we engaged with around student funding, this has also become a critical issue. And the minister has spoken about this in other fora, where, you know, we really need to address the balance of funding between supporting students in order to access higher education and training. Of course, significant amounts of that funding does go back into institutions in the form of tuition fees. But of course, some of that funding also goes to support students in other areas through the fully subsidized funding model, through accommodation and other needs that students have in order to succeed. So we are concerned about the proportional budget of the institutions, because it's important that if we are funding students, we have a responsibility to all the students in the system, including those who are supported from NSFAS and those who are self-funded, to be able to access high quality higher education and training, and also for us to over time reduce the inequalities between institutions. So in the long term, of course, the erosion will have very serious effects, but in the short term, we are able to manage those cuts by postponing certain programs and working very closely with the universities in terms of how they manage their budgets. But Chair, also some very important points from yourselves in terms of the fact that we need to become more efficient, and a lot of questions about that. I mean, certainly we're not just talking about, you know, we're talking about, the investment that we put in our universities and how that results in graduates and graduates with, you know, employable skills, a very important issue that we need to look at. And certainly we monitor that quite closely on an annual basis through cohort studies. We are seeing significant improvements in the throughput of students and in a reduction in the dropouts of students, partly because of initiatives around funding support for students, but also significant investments in supporting teaching and learning and student success initiatives. We have significant stimulatory funds in the system to support institutions around teaching and learning development. We have a university capacity development grant, which is supporting, I mentioned it in the presentation, but significant work going both to fund students to support their studies, but also supporting student success in other ways and gearing universities to become very focused on student success. We do, however, still have big concerns in our system, both in terms of the inequalities in outcomes and also in terms of the outcomes in distance education in particular, given that many students are working while they study. But I think the important point is that as much as we are focusing on inputs, we also need to focus on outputs, and we do need to focus on the improved efficiency of the system. And perhaps that's something we can also address in further engagements. Honourable Peters posed a question to the DG, which is a very difficult one around the feasibility of free education for all students. And maybe just to say that it's far be it from me to be able to answer that question, except that certainly we are seeing an increased demand for funding support, both because of the fact that more and more students are accessing higher education and TVET colleges and universities, and we are growing those institutions, but also because of the effects of COVID-19, many family circumstances have changed, and of course, our weak economy is putting a lot of pressure on families who need to access higher education and training. So certainly, it's likely that without significant additional funds, we would be unable to support, you know, further growth in the budgets. And I'm sure Treasury would talk to this. But of course, what we also need to do is to look at developing a sustainable policy that is in line with our government's goals of supporting all of those who deserve to access higher education, to get access to higher education and training, and then to be able to succeed as well. So we need to also look at different funding models and also additional sources of funding, and much to a certain extent the DG had referred to this, that we are going to have to be innovative and think out of the box in terms of what funding possibilities exist so that we can develop a more comprehensive student financial aid model to support the system going forward, and one that is sustainable and not a strain on the fiscus, but is also trying to meet our very important policy goals. And those policy goals are having significant effects. If I could also make one further point, which is to say that our cohort studies, honourable members, show that students who are NSFAS funded do perform significantly, on average, significantly better than other students on average. And so there is definitely a link between funding support being provided to students who need to access higher education and training and those students succeeding. So it's something that we can't drop the ball on, Chair and honourable members. And Honourable Peters, thank you for that tough question. But of course, those are questions that we are addressing very firmly at the moment through the student funding policy review, and we need to address that. Maybe on the other side, we also had a couple of questions that relate to the policy issues around student funding, and I think also important questions. Certainly, the issue of double dipping does concern us, but of course, we work very closely with the universities who have financial aid offices and are able to identify where this is happening. There's very strict rules in terms of NSFAS funding and double dipping, and we do rely quite closely on the partnerships with universities, NSFAS working with universities, and we do rely on those partnerships, and we do see benefits of that. Students who are NSFAS funded are certainly not allowed to take other funding for the same purposes that they are receiving NSFAS funding. And then the other issues around that Honourable Peters had mentioned around how students spend their allowances. Certainly, we see a lot of anecdotal information around this. And of course, the big issue being that we are aware that many students who come from really poor families also feel pressure and do indeed send funding home to their families. And particularly, I think that under the COVID pandemic, this was a big issue. So the question is, how do we ensure that the funding that is being provided to support students to succeed in higher education is actually being effective in doing that? So we do need to look at those kind of policy issues. Also, of course, relating to matters like the learning material allowance, which supports the students to be able to get devices as well as to access learning materials. So we are really focused on working with NSFAS and universities on many of those issues, and allowing universities also to put in place supporting mechanisms for their students that will allow them, on the one hand, to have choice with how they are spending their money. So for example, are they going to buy new textbooks, or are they going to access secondhand textbooks? And so it is important that students are able to get certain amounts of choice, but also be supported to ensure that the funding that they need to support their studies is actually being utilized for that purpose. And of course, from the state point of view, we need to ensure the efficiency of that funding. The question that Honorable Peters had asked about the savings of universities, I did touch on this briefly in the presentation, but just to say that we will get more information on this during this year once we receive the financial reports of institutions for 2020, and we will analyze those financial reports. But certainly from our initial engagement with institutions and from our engagement with them last year, it's very unlikely that universities will have had savings. And the reason for that is not to say that they wouldn't have had savings in particular areas, because of course there may have been reductions in accommodation costs, in the cost of municipal bills, for example, when they had long periods of absence from campus. But of course, many of those costs, had to be continued. In many, like on-campus residents, for example, students, there were still costs that had to be maintained. There are contracts that are in place. In some institutions where fee income is a significant contributor to university income, certain costs couldn't be covered because fees couldn't be charged for certain services that weren't offered. So as much as we try to mitigate this at a national level, engaging frameworks, certainly the savings weren't maybe as high as they may have appeared. And then the corollary of that, of course, is that institutions had significant additional expenses in 2020 as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic, both on the side of health and safety matters and needing to ensure that campuses were safe and on planning in those areas and PPE and those kinds of things, but and monitoring residences and access to campus, but also in terms of learning management systems, investment in IT infrastructure, providing support for access to devices for academics, additional training costs that were required, distribution costs where universities were distributing devices and paper-based materials to students, upgrades of learning management systems and software and bandwidth and those kind of things. So our initial assessment is that really it's very unlikely that certainly in the 2020 academic year that universities would have on balance made many savings, but actually some of the costs were quite significantly increased during that year. Just one last couple of things, DG, in terms of our long-term plans on student accommodation. I don't know if the DDG for planning would want to come into that, but certainly student accommodation is a major priority for the department, both in terms of our support through the infrastructure and efficiency grant, but also through work that is going on through the student housing infrastructure program, which is trying to leverage resources from, and DG had mentioned this actually in the opening, leverage resources from the private sector as well to support the growth of student housing, and very, very significant in terms of what Honorable Peters was saying about the importance of having conducive living environments for students to support their studies. We agree very much about that. And then also just in terms of infrastructure, the question around from the chairperson around that, we have a significant program in the department to support oversight of infrastructure funds, which involves a macro infrastructure program and online monitoring with institutions. We also provide active support to our universities in particular, but also to the TVET colleges in managing infrastructure funds. And there's been quite a significant growth in capacity at institution level in terms of managing infrastructure, in terms of the procurement of infrastructure. And we are seeing enormous growth and improvement in the time turnarounds of infrastructure projects, the spending on infrastructure funds, and certainly our monitoring capacity has grown enormously, but we do need to try and maintain that, and we're doing everything we can to ensure that even with the decrease in infrastructure funds, at least we maintain the level of oversight that we have begun to grow quite significantly. And then just in terms of R&D expenditure, just to say that, I mean, this is a joint shared responsibility with Department of Science and Innovation, which has a far smaller budget, but most of the research in the system, the majority takes place in the university system, as well as some in the science councils. But certainly as a system, with a relatively low investment in infrastructure and R&D, and so certainly something that we would hope to see growing, the university system in South Africa does kind of punch above its weight in terms of our research output. And we do actually contribute significantly to research outputs. Certainly on the African continent, we're one of the biggest producers of research, but also internationally we do make an impact, and we do have many areas where we have international recognition in our research. But of course, this is something that we would want to grow significantly, and the decrease in funding, the reductions in funding, both to DSI and ourselves are going to have an impact on that. But the department, of course, does contribute also significantly to R&D capacity through its research funding that it provides. And then maybe just one last point, DG and Chair, in terms of the demands and aspirations for higher education, I think the Chair made a really important point that we do need to, in the public imagination, really, I mean, this has two sides to it in a sense. On the one side is we need to build our post-school system and our articulation between different aspects of the different parts of the post-school system to really encourage people to start moving into much more into the TVET colleges, which can become institutions of choice. The demand and aspiration for higher education and for university education is extremely high, and this makes sense given that, you know, the graduates are more likely to get jobs. But actually, we're seeing the demand for, you know, for artisanal skills and for skills from TVET is also growing, and we need to, you know, both from an economy side, demand side, and supply side, you know, really build the capacity of all our institutions to try and do this. And certainly the funding reductions are not helping, because we are trying to rejig our post-school education and training system to really grow the TVET sector. But it is going to require significantly higher investment and particularly the development of capacity in that area so that we can, on the one side, show students that these are institutions of choice, and on the other side, you know, also provide real opportunities in the economy for students coming out of the full post-school system. Thank you very much, Chair, for the opportunity. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Tandi. Just a few questions that were directed to me. The notion of a free education, Chair, I think perhaps if I may start this way, government as early in the 1990s, when the pockets of funding from various donor funding pots were actually consolidated and converted into National Students Financial Aid Scheme. It was TESFA then, which the funding to a student was pegged at 122,000 combined family income. And that amount stayed up until 2010 or so. And it came as a result of some pressures in institutions whereby the funding with that amount of money led institutions to stop slice funding of students. They would look at students who are coming from poor families and give them at least some form of funding, but not the complete funding, the entire funding, which is required to finance a student to finish a qualification. And that led into building up of debt by a number of students. And in 2010, then realizing this problem, which was building up, there was an intervention by the president then through National Treasury of funding. I think it was in the region of about 5 billion into the system to actually alleviate some of the pressures in there. But that couldn't be quite sufficient into addressing this question that led to top slicing by institutions, which actually built enormous pressure that broke up into fees must fall. Then fast forward, then there was a determination and pronouncement 16th of December 2017 of taking that cap up to 350,000 combined family income per annum, which in the main assisted into addressing the question of access to higher education of students from poor and working class families. So those students in that category are actually getting free education indeed. That's what Tandi was talking about, whereby we're able to find them full cost of study insofar as paying fees, you know, everything in an institution, including accommodation allowance, a book allowance or learning material allowance. We included then, on top of that, a living allowance, which is about 290 or 70 per month, as well as food allowance for each and every student. And those allowances, I think that's the component that we are not able to control in respect to how a student should spend it, except to say that the intention of government is that you there, you're a student, you should not starve. At least there must be something that you are supported with so that you can be able to eat and be able to attend to your studies. Now, if then a student chooses to buy food for 40% of that amount, liquor for 60%, it's a matter that we don't have control on as yet. We are working out various mechanisms into ensuring that we minimize any form of wastage in respect to that. The problem, which is a pressure point insofar as the student funding is concerned, is that gap. We call it a missing middle between 351,000 to 600,000 combined family income. That is more middle class, your children from teachers, police, you know, civil servants in the main in that. So that is the area that we are working on now into ensuring that there is some mechanism of assistance so that these students can be able to access a higher education as well through form of making some facilities available to them to get in there. But this category of working class and the poor is getting free education indeed. Up to 350,000 combined family income. I think it's important that, so the work that the minister was instructed by cabinet to work on is in respect to addressing this question of the missing middle in the main. Of course, it may also look at reviewing the entire arrangement as a package and work it out a sustained policy intervention in respect to that. That's the work which is currently being undertaken at the present moment. Now, in terms of efficiencies in this mattered in supporting students. You raised this question and the possibilities of double dipping. No, it doesn't happen. The systems at institutional level, the systems at the NSFAS, they are quite prudent in ensuring that you get funding and you get it once. And I'm saying this knowing that there are other pockets of funding from CITAS, National Skills Fund, and some other government departments which are supporting students. In addition to this amount of 350,000 combined family income. So there are various interventions in there, but it has been ensured that in the systems up to an institutional level, there is no student who gets double dipping from the state. The other question that you are raising, Chair, is this one of maintenance. You are correct in respect to maintenance, but we have since intervened in this area, not quite adequately, but there is some work which is actually happening because the study we undertook in 2014 indicated that institutions combined, they've got up to the tune of 24 billion rand in deferred maintenance. So the point that you're making is quite correct. And you couple that with the pressures of demand for student accommodation as well as other infrastructure needs in institutions. So the money is not entirely enough. Hence then, we had to think out of the box and work out other mechanisms that would be able to mitigate and address this challenge of student accommodation, where we had engagement with Public Works, National Treasury, the then Economic Development Department, together with banks, fund management sector, development finance institutions, in order to work out a mechanism that would allow private sector to come into the party and be able to loan or borrow our institutions money for infrastructure rollout. And the culmination then of that was the DBSA coming to the party as well as the National Treasury, where we signed a memorandum of agreement in partnering into making some resources available so that the infrastructure rollout in building student accommodation in the main is rolled out, because according to our calculations then, if we were to rely only from state funding, over a period of 10 years, we would be able to provide about 30,000 new beds. Now, with the intervention of the National Treasury in releasing or making funds available from other areas of funding, EU, budget facility for infrastructure in there, as well as DBSA coming forward into saying the policy framework that has been developed does allow them to commit funds in borrowing to institutions so that they can be able to roll out infrastructure. So that led to the establishment of student housing management office, which is established there at the Development Bank of Southern Africa, which is looking at over a period of 10 years to at least having made available 300,000 new beds, both in universities as well as TVET colleges. But if then it can go up, it's fine. There are some interventions as well currently which were pronounced by the president, of which DBSA is a fund manager of those interventions, crowdfunding, which is from the private sector as well. But this program is actually being rolled out. There are about 13 new projects that are up in the pipeline now in various universities and TVET colleges as a second phase of that intervention by DBSA. On Monday, for instance, the minister will be at the University of Fort Hare launching a project, launching there the handover of student accommodation facilities that are finished. If I may just make an example there. In there, as the department, through funds that are transferred to institutions, Fort Hare contributed 122 million in that project. From the budget facility in the National Treasury, it is a top up of about 28 million. Then DBSA gave Fort Hare a loan of about 278 million. So they are able now to build beds of about, is it 2,700, somewhere there, close to 3,000 new beds in addition to that. So that is the facility, that is the arrangement which is in there. Now we're looking at escalating this. So there are quite a number of innovative interventions to try to mitigate these meager resources that we have at our disposal in support of the infrastructural rollout in institutions. So we are talking quite passionately about the training of artisans. National Skills Fund, as well as the CITAS, National Skills Fund has invested quite a lot in all state-owned companies for training of artisans. It's up and running in all of them. We have also partnered with some departments that have capacity to train the artisans. As a result, NDP put a target of the production of 30,000 artisans per annum by 2030. But that 30,000 we've exceeded already. We are producing more than 30,000 artisans per annum already, as a result of these interventions of combined funding in the main, driven from National Skills Fund. And CITAS are also engaging in other various programs in this respect, amongst other things. We have introduced in quite a number of institutions entrepreneurship programs so that our students, we don't teach them only how to get a qualification and how to look for a job. The intention is how to get a qualification and how you can set yourself in entrepreneurship activities so that you become an employer and a provider to yourself. So there are a number of interventions in respect to that are actually happening. I wish perhaps honorable members can just take a drive to Obit TVET College, Mankweng campus. It's just next to N1C, what do we call? Sun City, yes, Sun City. So in there, students who are doing mechanic, they are not doing mechanic just for a qualification. They are also get an incubation program as to how, as a mechanic, you can be able to set up a business for yourself. And the studies then that come up is showing that the students who have gone through that program are able to earn living just by themselves without anybody employing them. So those are some of the interventions, you know, in the system. But Chair, we welcome any comment and support we could be getting into ensuring that we maximize the impact in respect to the work that we are doing. Honorable Member Peters, is correct that the University of Solplaki is up and growing, you know, at the present moment, and is a new institution, which is a pride of that province in as much as it is a pride of the country. So thank you very much, Chair, with the those questions and our attempt to clarify ourselves to the extent that we have done, and any other thing would be amenable for a follow-up or either in the form of writing, and have continuous interactions with SCOA. And we would really like to appeal for the support of SCOA so that we can be able to get a better share that would make things a bit easier for our children to access education. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, DG again, and your team. Let me also assure you that National Treasury is also here on the platform that listening to you. Before I close, let me put you on the spot. I made a statement which says employers discriminate against students who have got an accent like mine, which means that people who came out from the universities that they are talking about. Your comment, please. And I even said that unfortunately even the public institutions do that. What would you say to that?
No, thank you very much, Chair. No, that question, Chair, I won't say it's a discrimination per se, but of course, it's a matter that would relate to a perception. And I don't think it's a matter which is confined to higher education sector. Even at school level, as a parent, when you consider which primary school, which high school my child should go to, what you look at is which school is deemed to be producing good results for whatever reason. And as a parent, you'd actually be attracted into getting a place for your child in that particular school or the other school. But what I want to say is that the prestige of program offerings, it's what defines a school, it's what defines an institution. Now, if the perception out there is that the provision of programs from this institution or that institution is not that good, that perception that society carries, and it has got nothing to do with facts. Hence, the interventions that we have initiated in respect to student support, upgrading the qualifications of lecturers who are already in our institutions to attain PhDs, to become professors, because that's how you get an enhanced prestige of an institution, so that our institutions in their totality are known to be producing good graduates, you know, out of them, so that the market, job market out there, and them, how they would be carrying themselves in undertaking their responsibilities, it becomes quite important. I think that in the main, it's a societal matter that we are grappling with, and I think we need to do so as a collective, and we need your support in respect to that as well. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, DG. Let me just share with you something. My niece some years ago asked me and said, Madume, why do you guys, when you speak, you like saying, and she said, even Mandela, when he speaks, will say, and then he speaks. And I said to him, it's because we're very clever. We think in Zulu, or we think in Xhosa, and I must speak in English. Other people think in English just like yourself. So I'm just saying that as I like what you are saying, that the perception has got nothing to do with reality sometimes, but it's something that I think we should be alive to, especially the Department of Higher Education and Training. When it comes, we must walk the talk, we as government and our institutions, to ensure that we don't, based on perceptions, end up discriminating against people who are produced by our own institutions. Look, DG, where did you said the Mankweng Tibet is next to Sun City?
Yes, it's a campus of Orbit Tibet College.
Oh, okay.
Yes, we partnered there with the Department of Small Business as well as Ford. So Ford donated a van there to be used by students in the area of mechanics. And
is Mankweng not Teflo?
Not that one.
Okay.
Not that one, Honorable Member. It's just next to Sun City. It's just an easy drive, you know, going there.
Yeah.
So then with the small business, we developed a program so that they could be trained into how to set up a business for themselves, having attained those skills. So it's incubation in there. So they are taken through that program and it's doing quite very well for them.
And I think that should be supported at DG and be multiplied at other places, because I think that we really need that. When you have got your electricity problem, you need an electrician who you can call in the township to come and fix your own electricity. But let me thank you, DG, again. And look, I think I've been educated on a number of things that the department is doing. And I think the same with the honorable members and other people who have joined us. And I think the moral of the story, DG, and which is a problem with the government in general, let's communicate the good things that we do. I think it's very important. Let not us be probed before we talk about all these good things that we are doing. And the initiatives that we are having with DPSA and so on, these are the things that our people should know, that with all the problems that we are having as government, what are these things that we are doing? With those few words, let me thank you, DG, and your team, and wish you well as you navigate some of the challenges that the department is facing. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Chair, for your support and the counseling on these particular matters.
But before you take leave, Darren, let's correct the omission that we had.
Yes, Chairperson. The Minister, we did receive an apology on behalf of the Minister of Higher Education. He's busy attending to a long-standing scheduled commitment, so he was not in a position to join the meeting today. I have inadvertently omitted his apology when we did the apologies when the meeting started. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, let's note that the apology, I thought you should hear it at DG, but thank you very much. That takes care of the presentation by the Department of Higher Education and Training. Let's go to the next item just quickly, Honorable Peters. There's one item that we need to deal with. Darren?
So are we excused, the Chair?
Yes, you are. You are, definitely.
Thank you.
Thank you. Darren?
Chairperson?
Yeah, let's deal with the next agenda item. The technical corrections to the 2021 appropriation bill.
Yes, Chair. If members can remember, on the 4th of May, when National Treasury made a presentation on the appropriations bill and the special appropriations bill, they also indicated that there are technical corrections that need to be made. Those technical corrections have been tabled in the National Assembly, so the committee just needs to consider it and in principle agree to the technical amendments. Those are the amendments related to the naming of two departments, It's just technical corrections. It's got nothing to do with allocations. Yes, Chair. That's it.
Yeah. Just talk about those. Honourable members, so that there's no confusion. Just talk about the departments that needed to change their names or to correct their names.
Yeah, I just want to open it quickly.
Please do that.
It's a forestry and fisheries and environment and sports, arts and culture.
That is correct, Chairperson. It's those two.
Yeah. Yes. So, honourable members, let's say we need to agree on that. It's more of a technical change of the names more than anything else. Okay, agreed.
I so move, Chair, but Darren, just help us before we move. The one of sports, arts and culture, I don't seem to understand what is the amendment there, because it just reads the same.
Madam, I thought exactly the same. You'll see the first one says sports, multiple, and the second one says sport, arts and culture.
Okay.
That's the change.
So which one is the change? Sports?
They are proposing that we change it from sports, art and culture to sport, arts and culture.
I move for the acceptance, Chairperson, of both names. The other one was going to make the EFF very happy because it was reading environment, forestry and fisheries. I'm also very happy that it's amended.
So it's amended to
FFE.
Yeah. I think more than anything else, so that there's no confusion, Honorable Shonyan. Ignore Honorable. Let us go into the department may end up going to EFF and vice versa.
Yes.
Agreed, honourable members. Agreed. No dissenting voice. I think we'll continue. That is more of a technical change. Okay. Thank you. That takes care of that agenda item. Any announcements?
Next meeting is on Friday, Chairperson, where we will have public hearings on the special appropriation bill.
What time?
It's starting at 9 on Friday morning, Chair. That link I will send tomorrow morning.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. Honourable members, that takes care of the meeting. Thank you very much. We had long sessions today. And thank you for your indulgence.
Thank you, Chair.
Support staff and everybody.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. The meeting stands adjourned. Thank you.